Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents My 30-Minute Bar Mitzvah, a Memoir, by Dennis Herson. Narrated by Dennis Herson. For Anna and Jeremy. Part 1. The Lady with the Violet Hair. Chapter 1. Of course I had a bar mitzvah. It took place on a cool, crisp afternoon in Johannesburg on the day I turned 13, towards the end of August 1964. There were three other people present, or five, depending on whom one chooses to include. Five, let's say, the men divided from the women according to the time-worn tradition. There were no photographs, no gifts bought or made for the occasion, no singing or elevating sound, unless one counts the bellyfuls of steam rising up from the iron grid between the flagstones of the pavement across the road. But the steam hardly made a whisper, and anyway, I cannot be sure that I noticed it at all. The ceremony lasted precisely 30 minutes, as had been agreed on well in advance, not a second longer. One of the people present announced the end in a voice as blunt as it was relieved. Did I cross the threshold into manhood on that day as one is, at least symbolically, supposed to do? I don't know. I doubt it. But I did at least, in the wake of this event, begin to understand a number of things I had not been confronted with before. The person who might have been called my teacher would surely have wanted me to learn these lessons in an entirely different way, if I had to learn them at all. But there was no time beforehand, and not a moment left over at the end, to express any regret. There was no Hebrew spoken during my bar mitzvah, nor did I read out aloud a portion of the consecrated biblical text. Everything happened in one language, or possibly two, but Hebrew was neither of them. I already knew a number of Hebrew words, for example, those that mean good morning and good night, peace, excuse me, please and thank you, boy and girl, water, and prickly pear. I also knew that Baruch meant blessed, and that Yael meant ibex, which is a kind of goat. Those were the names of my parents, Baruch and Yael. I was the fruit of the union between a blessed one and a wild mountain goat, the first of their three children, the eldest by 7.5 years, and also the eldest grandchild on both sides. As might be expected, Baruch is a holy word. It is also the beginning of many prayers. Baruch Ata Adonai, blessed art thou, Lord. I would have appreciated just a touch of holiness to add to proceedings during my 30-minute ceremony, and why not even a prayer? Someone might have raised a ladder of luminous words mounting rung by rung beyond the narrow, low-roofed confines where the occasion took place. This proved to be not only impossible, but entirely unthinkable. Several of my companions had already started learning Hebrew in preparation for their bar mitzvahs at the age of 11 or even earlier. On afternoons after school, they disappeared behind the door of a room adjoining the newly built local Orthodox shul, which stood like a sentinel among blocks of flats and scattered trees not 3 minutes from the school soccer field. I watched them emerging an hour or so later as if they had been forcibly held under water, spluttering Hebrew syllables and exchanging jibes about their teacher, who was apparently no more than a doddering old clown. Bavakakakaka, ani rotze, ani rotze, ani rotten tomatoes. Bonded together in mockery, they hopped around on the grass of the soccer field, the sound of their laughter rippling upwards like a single shared flag of belonging above their heads. Though they might have needed to exorcise from their bodies the boredom of their lessons, there was no question of their wanting to escape the ultimate goal. They would all end up having a bar mitzvah in shul one Saturday morning or another in the foreseeable future. They would walk down the carpet with the eyes of the men and boys, as also the women and girls in the upper gallery, upon them. They would approach the raised lectern, passing row upon row of men wearing yarmulkes and draped in tallises, then stand at the sacred scroll and read from it to the congregation before being showered with gifts and adoration and going on to have a feast and make a speech in a marquee. Such a procession of Jewishness they brought together before me, those boys. Stanley and J.P., who was an orphan and once had ringworm, Colin, who, accidentally with a cricket ball, broke my front tooth, Johnny with the swimming pool at the bottom of his garden where Doris Day had dipped her shapely body one fabled afternoon. There was Derek with his smooth raven black hair and his violin, freckle-faced David, Peter of the hospitable mansion with a boxing bag swinging in the middle of the garden and a great cage of singing birds to one side, Boyke and his inexhaustible supply of jokes, Malcolm, Stephen, Ashley, Jackie, whose house had recently been burgled, slothful, scheming Paul of the slack belly and bank bags bloated with marbles. Whatever has become of those boys, I wonder, every one of them from the plush and luxuriant, tree-lined northern suburbs of Johannesburg in the early 1960s. Then again, was I not from the same suburbs and Jewish too? What was so different about my family? Well, we did live in the most ramshackle house on our block, with earthquake cracks across the inside walls, goose-pimpled plaster on the outside, and, unlike any of my friends' houses, ours was filled with almost nothing new. As of the age of 8 or 9, I was out with my father weekend after weekend scouting for furniture in other people's homes. Their inhabitants had fled the country in the wake of the Sharpeville massacre, the ensuing marches and violent repression of 1960. Added to this were the widely, luridly reported doings of the Mau Mau in Kenya. "The writing is on the wall for the whites," went the rumour, and South Africa's airports and harbours were a hive of activity that year as, with anxious alacrity, white families packed up and left. We, of course, were never going to leave. Not ever. My friend's parents might talk of buying a one-way ticket for London or Melbourne or New York, but not mine. And anyway, we had just moved into our new antiquated house. So, on a Saturday afternoon, my father and I would add ourselves to a little crowd following a well-fed auctioneer about from room to stripped room of what had once been an absent stranger's stately abode. After a few hours, we drove back home to proudly lay our loot before my mother: Keelum carpets, a pinewood Swedish desk, lamps, vases, kitchenware, imbuer, armchairs, a Morris settee dotted with little maroon roses. At first, the effect of all these things, once installed, was somewhat theatrical, like a stage set for what really stole the limelight in our house: books. I knew no one else whose house was filled with as many books, pushing their way up from the pinewood floors to the moulded ceilings, books with my parents' first names inscribed inside them, looped together and underlined in my father's meticulous script, Baruch and Yael, as if this were both their joint fortune and the contract of their togetherness. Our garden, too, was different. The grass was as worn as a moth-eaten cloth, the flower beds lacking in that lush, perky look that comes with constant care. We had a gardener, but he was absent for weeks on end, a withdrawn, soft-spoken man who may well have been involved in some kind of political activity. On several occasions, I saw my father speaking to him quietly around the back of the house. Perhaps he was eventually arrested. Whatever the case, he finally disappeared, after which the grass was gradually worn even thinner than before. But never mind the state of the grass or the surfeit of books or our adopted furniture, we were from the same suburbs as all my friends, even if it felt as if we weren't. And what about the fact of being Jewish? That was a secret which I myself could not crack. From an early age I was somehow made aware that sharing this secret with strangers might possibly be dangerous. But it was also not to be spoken of within the walls of our own house, despite the fugitive signs that Jewishness was very much a part of our lives. Take my father's whistling, for example. In the late afternoon or evening, he would come home from the university, where he was a physics lecturer, walk through the front door and whistle, the same six brief, sharp notes, ending with a seventh long one, every time. In answer to this call, my mother, if she was already back from medical school, would emerge from wherever she had been to greet him. They had told me where this whistling tune came from, HaShomer HaTzair, the youth movement better known to them as HH. As a boy, I learnt, without really understanding, that HH was Zionist, and therefore Jewish, as well as socialist, and was one strand of the bond between them since they had both been members. But when they mentioned this, which was not often, the Zionist part was passed over in silence, and the Jewish part went mysteriously missing, like a piece of an almost completed jigsaw puzzle that is found to be lost, whose shape can clearly be guessed at, but unfortunately not filled. I knew it was there, hidden somewhere out of sight, but the words for it were not available to me. Why was this so? I did not know, nor did I try and find out. Perhaps that was simply the way things were. Perhaps I had, or made sure I had, other things on my mind, such as catching a new kind of beetle for my beetle collection, or boiling another golf ball. The people next door sometimes chipped a golf ball into our back garden, and I boiled it, slicing off the dimpled outer resin skin and cutting through the densely meshed rubber thread below to get to the bag of yellowish gel hidden in the middle. That tiny bag was a sort of secret, and I liked secrets. I was a solitary child, and secrets were part of the way I kept to myself. There were lots of them in the stories I read. They were what made me turn to the next page. They had power, but only as long as they were not yet revealed. In other words, you had to know about their existence, though their inner meaning might remain elusive for a considerable amount of time. Like Jewishness. If I was the least bit curious about it, then I buried my curiosity. I did not want any angry answers entering the quietness of my world. And vaguely, distantly, I sensed that if I asked the wrong question, then anger would come rumbling forth from my father, though I hardly knew why. There were also other secrets in our house, and I definitely knew I should not ask about them. I don't know whether I needed any proof that these particular secrets had power, but, as if I did, there came a day when one of them exploded, and then nothing was ever the same again. For all my solitariness, or more likely because of it, I badly wanted to play sport at school, especially in a team. Sport was something that could easily be shared with my classmates in the long blue hours after school. The only problem being that I was a lousy sportsman. But I was lucky. One fateful afternoon, out on our school soccer field, when our coach, Mr. Spur, was choosing boys for the under-10 team, he told me to go and stand between the goalposts. "Jump," said Mr. Spur, kicking the ball to one side. I jumped. This is one of two very different moments that come immediately to mind when I think of sport at primary school. The big moment of inner brightness when I flexed my knees, pushed myself upwards, and in the resulting airborne state was so amazed to find the ball securely in my outstretched hands that I did not even feel the bump when I landed. A few more kicks, a few more saves, and I received the coveted pale blue jersey that meant I was the goalie in the school team. This was all the more remarkable since the other positions on the field were definitely beyond my reach. I could run all right, but when it came to dribbling, passing, and shooting, either my boots did not find the ball or, when they did, The ball clearly had intentions of its own. Goalkeeping was different. Most of the time, you just had to stop the ball, not get involved in the business of furthering its intricate, obstacle-filled journey to the far side of the field. And if ever your body left the ground in order to intercept the ball's trajectory, the ground was sure to be there when you came back down. This explains why I preferred soccer to swimming. The problem with swimming was all the water. It was fine to float on a lilo in the sun, but what was the point of putting your face into the water so that it masked you, rushing through your mouth and nostrils as urgently as if they were plug holes? Wouldn't it just have been easier to breathe in the fresh air while walking around the pool if you had to get to the other side? I was never going to be selected to represent our school at swimming, but, like all the others who were not in the team, I had to go along when there was an inter-school gala. This, unfortunately, brings me to the second moment I think of when it comes to sport at primary school, because there was just such a gala in progress one late morning in northern Johannesburg at the Zoolake Municipal Swimming Bath. Doing breaststroke down their lanes in the rippling silver-blue jelly of the pool were seven or eight girls in shiny skins and costumes and plastic swimming caps, water parting neatly before their dipping, rising faces. All around them, various school war cries erupted from among the children packing the stands. And, at the top of one of those stands, a group of us, deciding that it must be time to eat, took out our lunch boxes and opened our homemade, wax-paper-wrapped contents. All, that is, except for one boy who had forgotten to bring his sandwiches with him. "Opsasasami," he requested, of no one in particular, and, from the place immediately in front of him, where I happened to be sitting, I handed back one of my mother's offerings. There was a pause, and then the sandwich was returned to me with a single fatal bite missing. "It isn't kosher," the boy announced, so that everyone could hear each syllable that came shooting with burning intensity in my direction. I was filled with sudden inner darkness, though my face must have been flaming red. That boy, inside left in our soccer team, third or fourth in our class after Leonie Hofmeyer, who always came first and was right then busy winning the race down the shaken-up waters of the pool, that boy, soon to be one of the bar mitzvah boys at the local shul, had, at least in my eyes, instantaneously turned into the representative of an entire group, a tightly bonded community several generations deep now massed against me with a flock of furrowed brows angled in my direction. Who did I imagine all those people to be? Prominent among them were not only the Jewish children at our school, but also members of their families. I had seen them often enough at the side of the soccer field supporting their sons, later driving away in spacious, gleaming cars. I had myself been ferried to and from matches in those same cars by mothers who had slow voices and tea parties and all the time in the world. I had exchanged occasional distant glances with the fathers who also pitched up at matches once in a while, wearing rings and glittery ties with tie pins, stretching their smiles between plump, immobile cheeks. I had even been welcomed into some of their big, spotless homes. Out on their verandas I had been waited upon by servants wearing starched white livery. But now, because of my unkosher sandwich, I felt their indignant collective presence come pressing in on all sides until I became the accused in a court case, certain that the Jewish boys up there in the stands were busy passing judgment on me. How could it be otherwise, since even inside me, there were elusive, latent forces of ancestry at work, pressures for which I could barely find a name. My mind went numb and my tongue stalled as, with no alibi to call on, I faced the irrefutable charge of transgression. There, right under my nose, was the un-Jewish evidence against me, my unsuspecting mother's sandwich. It consisted of 2 fresh slices of brown Atlas bread filled with succulent roast veal and rosemary and fine slices of cucumber. It was also unmistakably and irreparably lined with butter. My classmates and I were 10 or 11 years old, and it was 1961, the year after the Sharpeville massacre. Dr. Verwoerd, the Prime Minister, had declared a republic, which meant that we had to go to the school hall and learn to sing the national anthem in English as well as Afrikaans, with our teacher, Mrs. Miles, sitting at the piano. She had straight hair dyed henna red and arranged as neatly as a wig over her head, with a fringe in front. Sometimes in class, she asked her pet pupil to comb it. She also had dyed eyebrows and big cheeks, and the tops of her arms wobbled when she played. A new young teacher, called Mr. Reinecker, who dressed very smartly and kept flicking his glossy quiff out of his eyes, stood on the stage using both hands to conduct our singing as if he were directing the traffic. Earlier in the year, he had tried to teach us to sing the Lord's Prayer in the same way, but once again our efforts did not please him in the least, so we had to start several times over, ringing out from our blue heavens, "Uit die blauw van onze hemel." "Blauw," insisted Mr. Reinecker, opening his mouth wide and describing an O as wide as a hula hoop with his arms, while Mrs. Miles asked a boy in the front row to go and fetch her another glass of water. My father definitely disliked Dr. Verwoerd and told me not to go to school on Republic Day, when we were all supposed to receive a little national flag and a medal, but Mrs. Miles kept them for me anyway. Soon, because of the Republic, we had freshly minted money in our pockets when standing in line at the school tuck shop at break. Gone was the brown one-penny coin showing on one side the demure British Queen Elizabeth II Regina. She had recently also been our queen, or almost our queen, but now she definitely wasn't. On the other side used to be an old sailing ship that might have brought her ancestors across the ocean to our shores. But on the new 1 cent coin, which was yellowish and sat so lightly in the palm of the hand that it felt like play money, the ship had been replaced by an ox wagon, one belonging to the Voortrekkers, whom, we learnt, had once upon a time come trekking northwards from the Cape, singing songs and shooting at lions and tribes. As for the Queen, she had been replaced by Jan van Riebeck from Holland. There he was, in his lace collar and moustache and wavy waterfall of hair, just as he had been on landing in his ship in 1652. The first man ever to set foot on the shores of the Cape, we were told, only to be met by a straggly little crowd of bushmen. "Unity is strength, Eendracht maak mag," was written in capital letters on the coin all the way around van Riebeck's dapper bust. This meant that he and I had something in common. If unity was important to him, then it was to me too, at least to a certain degree. Whatever the content of my sandwiches, I wasn't British, nor was I an Afrikaner. I was, in fact, one of the Jewish boys in the class, wasn't I, even if only because I wasn't anything else. And though I might not know what exactly this meant to me, I hardly wanted to stick out among the others like an unkosher thumb. I had shared one of my mother's scrumptious sandwiches with a boy I had thought of as a sort of friend. As a result, that boy now had a problem because, sitting all the way at the top of the packed stands in the middle of a swimming gala, he had to find somewhere to spit out his polluted mouthful. I spoke to no one about this incident, but it stuck inside me like a splinter and would not go away. How could I invite a Jewish boy over to our house if there were going to be problems about the food served at mealtimes? So I turned to Barry. Barry played centre-half in our school soccer team, a pivotal position for a skillful player. Everyone liked him. He was crack at marbles, too. He had a finely drawn face, a soft voice, and he was not Jewish. I asked him over and was in turn invited to his place. We played soccer with Barry's brother, out in the garden, as well as our version of French cricket, with an upturned tomato crate for a wicket. We sat at the kitchen table and did our homework together. One summer, Barry's family invited me to their farm. For the first time, I saw a sheep with its belly cut open and guts spilling out, khaki green, into the dust of the yard. I was taught to use a pellet gun, then shot at a bird to prove I could do it. And at some point I said something against another boy in our class, remarking that it would be difficult to invite him to the farm. He, after all, would only eat kosher food. Years later, that same boy, a young man by then, paid me a visit and reminded me sharply of what I had said. All three of us had been friends, hadn't we? Good friends. And with the shield of my need and the knife of my uncertainty, I had betrayed one of us, wanting the other to myself, seeking out a territory where I could draw closer to someone my age, despite the unspoken, bristling contradictions that surrounded me. Badly needing the company of one boy, I had stood on a second one to reach him, denying the fact that he too was a friend, and also that we were both of the same lineage. Chapter 2. Being Jewish was one thing. Having something to do with Israel was quite another. Israel was always in my vicinity, or not altogether, like a person who hadn't yet rung the doorbell, or had rung it, but was somewhere else when you opened the door. Israel was a country unlike any of the others because it wasn't only on the map, nor in the end was it just outside the house. It had mysteriously already come in and was right in the middle of people's lives. For a start, there were the Keren Kayemet boxes, especially in the neighborhood some distance from our own, where my father's parents, Granny Lily and Grandpa Joe, lived. The boxes were blue and white, made of tin, about the size of a fat book, with a sort of spring, I thought, around the inside of the slot at the top so as, I supposed, to prevent anyone from trying to get the money out. I never tried. They were often placed at the entrance to houses next to the black Bakelite telephone or propping up a set of dog-eared thrillers on a shelf. If you put some money into the slot, then it would go to Israel and trees would be able to grow there. How exactly this happened, I could not work out. In the first place, I had never seen anyone actually come to take the boxes away, or for that matter, bring them back again. Nonetheless, I checked that they were sometimes filled and sometimes empty, which meant that there were mysterious hands reaching into people's houses to get them because of the trees. Why trees, I wondered. Why not spend at least some of the money on a cake mixer for Granny Lily, for example, since she really could do with a new one? I supposed that there weren't any trees in Israel, or hardly any. Maybe the whole country was bald, and people had to stand at the side of the sea waiting for ships to bring in the trees they so badly needed. Could a shilling, or even half a crown, really help to buy one? Granny Lily's Keren Kayemet box was on a low, almost marble, veined beige mantelpiece above the electric heater in the living room. A troop of ebony elephants with ivory tusks went marching all the way up to it, the biggest elephant in front and a baby one with tiny tusks bringing up the rear. Mr. and Mrs. Goodman, next door, also had a box, and so did Mr. Harrison a few gates down, but that was before his wife died, and he left, and his house had to be fumigated. Mr. Goodman was a bar mitzvah teacher, and he had a piano that occupied a whole room. A few of the keys were a bit brown at the edges, like smokers' fingers. Sometimes I would be near the tall brick wall that separated my grandmother's yard from the Goodman's house, spending a long time listening to what was going on in there. Sunlight sharpened the bits of broken bottle stuck in the cement at the top of the wall, while from the other side came the sound of a boy's voice diligently following Mr. Goodman's instructions up and down the piano notes on the way to his bar mitzvah. Mr. Goodman's son Hershey had already had one. Afterwards, he started wearing a leather jacket to go with his ducktail hairstyle, but now everything was all right because he was in Israel.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?